bias towards things that we don't know or communities that we're not a part of, and adds to the stereotypes, biases, and miseducation, and stands in the way of solidarity for all of our communities.
The other two groups contesting the Edison Research NAP data are the Native American Rights Fund and the National Congress of American Indians. Edison Research tells National Native News that given factors like the small sample size and the potential sampling error, the survey data should not be taken as a definitive word on the American Indian vote. The proper repatriation of Native American remains is behind a new facility in Corvallis, Oregon. It's a collaboration between Oregon State University and the 9 federally recognized tribes within the state. Called the OSU NAGPRA facility, the two buildings are about 2,000 square feet total. They're for consultation, records, and storing human remains in accordance with the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. The 1990 federal law mandates the safe return of skeletons, bones, and cultural items to their tribes. Ashley Russell is Director of Natural Resources and Culture for the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. She credits sensitive discussions among tribes, OSU, and the state in making this facility possible.
It's just very important to us as tribes to have that relationship and it not be a transactional thing, because these are ancestors. They've made their journey on the other side, and you have to be careful when you navigate those sorts of things.
OSU's NAGPRA director, Don Marie Alapisco, was pleased with the support.
This is a change, a shift in how NAGPRA can and should be performed.
NAGPRA compliance has been a constant sore spot between many tribes and institutions. Some universities have retained bones and remains in years past, citing research needs. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings, Kathleen Shannon, and Julia Chilton. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282VH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. And if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, coming up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. South Korea's president declares martial law. The Hong Kong 47 are sentenced, and the International Criminal Court issues arrest warrants for two Israeli leaders. First, South Korea's president declares martial law. In a shocking move to end political deadlock, South Korea's president Yoon Suk-yeol declared martial law Tuesday, the first time that has happened since the end of dictatorship in South Korea in the 1980s. He cited numerous impeachment actions against government officials and drastic budget cuts, saying, quote, "The government is paralyzed and constitutional order has been trampled. An insurrection, in short," he said, "that would aid the pro-North Korean anti-state forces." The National Assembly immediately and unanimously voted to lift martial law, however, and mass demonstrations in Seoul showed strong popular support for impeaching the president. Now, unless President Yoon, who was elected in 2022 for a five-year term, has the military support for suppressing the demonstrations and maintaining martial law, he will be removed. The Hong Kong 47 are sentenced. 47 Hong Kong pro-democracy activists were sentenced November 19th for conspiracy to subvert state power, a catch-all charge often used by pro-Beijing authorities to nab and try dissidents. In this case, the Hong Kong 47 were guilty of taking part in a primary election, July 2020, that was not officially sanctioned, but participated in by hundreds of thousands of Hong Kongers. It was following that election that Beijing imposed a national security law, a dragnet that now has thoroughly decimated the pro-democracy forces. Most of those convicted were sentenced to 4 years and a few to several months. Probably the best known of the 47 is Jimmy Lai, the media baron accused of sedition for colluding with foreign forces. His sentencing, says Professor Ho-Fung Hung at Johns Hopkins University, quote, sends a signal that Hong Kong's democratic movement, freedom of the press, and free elections are done with. Yet Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer would not express support for the dissidents. In the official United Kingdom readout of a meeting with Xi Jinping at the G20 summit in Rio de Janeiro, Starmer hoped for, quote, deepening the partnership bilaterally on trade and investment, health, education, and other areas of mutual interest, and said that he also wanted to engage honestly and frankly on those areas where we have different perspectives, including on Hong Kong, human rights, and Russia's war in Ukraine. After the meeting, Starmer was asked twice for his views on the sentencing. He would only say the United Kingdom, quote, mustn't lose the opportunity for our economy. He referred to the need to discuss differences with China, but kept coming back to the need to cooperate with China on economic and trade affairs. A pragmatic, serious relationship is the right relationship to have with China, Starmer told the BBC. And that's a Labour government, mind you. The Conservative Party leader, Duncan Smith, derided Starmer for his remarks, which Smith said, quote, means that he and his government are so desperate for trade, they will turn a blind eye to all future atrocities. Starmer, by the way, was not alone in bowing to China's trade power. Australia's Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, also met with Xi at Rio. Albanese said he discussed human rights and several other controversial issues with Xi, but pointed out to reporters that, quote, one in four Australian jobs are export dependent, and one in four of our export dollars comes from China. Like Starmer, Albanese stressed the importance of dialogue with China. He too heads the Labour Party. In contrast, the EU Parliament condemned the sentencing, called for repeal of the national security law, and urged immediate release of all the activists. The parliament called on EU members to, quote, warn China that its actions on Hong Kong will have consequences for EU-China relations, including targeted sanctions on Hong Kong officials. The International Criminal Court issues arrest warrants for two Israeli leaders. As reported by the Times of Israel, in a massive legal bombshell, the International Criminal Court, the ICC, issued arrest warrants for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant over the war in Gaza. The court's three judges found that they had, quote, intentionally and knowingly deprived the civilian population in Gaza of objects indispensable to their survival, including food, water, and medicine, and that these two Israeli leaders had, quote, intentionally directed attacks against the civilian population of Gaza. As the Times of Israel noted, the decision marked the first time the ICC has ever issued arrest warrants against leaders of a democratic country. The court also issued a warrant for Hamas military chief Mohammed Deif, who Israel says was killed by an Israeli strike in Gaza in July. The warrants mean that Netanyahu and Gallant are subject to arrest if they travel to any of the 120 countries that are signatories of the Rome Statute that established the ICC. Israel and the United States are not parties to the treaty, and the Biden administration has already announced that the two Israeli leaders will not be apprehended if they travel to the United States. But France, Netherlands, and possibly the United Kingdom have already indicated that they will comply with the ICC's ruling. People accused of crimes against humanity or war crimes cannot be tried unless apprehended. Netanyahu has accused the chief judge of anti-Semitism and corruption. He said, quote, "This is an anti-Semitic act that has one goal, to deter me, to deter us from exercising our natural right to defend ourselves against our enemies who rise up against us to destroy us, accusing the state of Israel of genocide while we are working to defend ourselves from an enemy who is trying to commit genocide against us," unquote. Officers in the Israeli Defense Forces, interviewed about the ICC decision, maintain the military is doing the best it can to avoid harm to civilians. But, they say, this is war. In other news, U.S. Middle East policy will be a family business. Jared Kushner is once again knee-deep in corruption, this time being clever enough to stay out of an official position in the incoming administration. Writing in the online journal Popular Information, Judd Legum and Noel Sims trace Kushner's exploitation of his Saudi connections to make millions of dollars offering investment advice. Kushner's private equity firm, Alliance Partners, relies mainly on funds from Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, which is subject to final decisions by the notorious Mohammed bin Salman, Kushner's buddy. Thus, while that fund hasn't earned a dime, Kushner draws huge sums in management fees from investors that now include Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. Those investments total around $5 billion. The conflict of interest for Kushner, now that his father-in-law is about to return to the White House, is obvious. Kushner continues to advise Trump, maintains relations with Middle East dictators and with the Netanyahu administration in Israel, and is regularly on the phone with people in and out of government who want advice on Middle East policy. By law, Kushner should be a registered foreign agent of Saudi Arabia, but don't count on his doing anything of the sort. To the contrary, Kushner is likely to employ all the benefits of a policy insider without having to divulge anything about what is he advising or how much he is profiting. And there's more. Charles Kushner, Jared's father, convicted felon, and Trump donor, will be appointed ambassador to France. And Massad Boulos, father-in-law of Trump's daughter Tiffany, will be appointed White House senior advisor on Arab and Middle East affairs. In all, Middle East policy is captive to Donald Trump's extended family, which means unlimited weapons for Israel and no resistance to Israel's expansionist ambitions. Iran agrees to cap its enriched uranium stockpile. Rafael Grossi, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, announced that Iran had agreed to cap its stockpile of uranium to 60% enrichment, which is well short of the enrichment level needed for nuclear weapons. Moreover, Grossi reported, Iran had already begun implementing the cap under IAEA supervision. He called the understanding, quote, "a very, very important development indeed." Iran's action comes as the U.S., Britain, France, and Germany prepared a resolution requesting that the Director General, quote, "produce a comprehensive and updated assessment on the possible presence or use of undeclared nuclear material found at some sites in Iran." Iran might reverse its decision on capping in response to that resolution, though another and more likely Iranian reaction is to use its cooperation to gain international support in the conflict with Israel. China is on track to be the leading carbon emitter. Historically, the U.S. and Europe have ranked 1 and 2 in carbon emissions. But China, which is the leading annual emitter, is on track to be number one by around the year 2100. China is already number two, surpassing the European Union. The reason for China's rise is, well, China's rise. The extraordinary economic growth fueled in large part by coal. Even though China is also a world leader in wind and solar power, its very size and rapid economic development ensure it will be number one before long. However, account also has to be taken of emissions per person, and there the U.S. role becomes most apparent. It is several times that of China. That raises the question of whether and how China should pay the developing countries to fight global warming. China argues that it has paid something around $25 billion, but its books on climate financing are not open to inspection. China continues to insist on being considered a developing country. That is one among several complications when it comes to fundraising to help truly developing countries, since the richest countries, such as Saudi Arabia, the United States, the EU, and others, all disclaim responsibility for funding climate change to the limit of their capabilities. However, at the conclusion of the COP29 climate summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, on November 24th, these same countries agreed to an annual $300 billion contribution for low-income countries by 2035. Now all the United Nations has to do is collect on the pledges. Developing countries were not at all happy, since the total contribution fell well short of the amount most of them believe is necessary, around $1.3 trillion. An optical illusion, India's delegate said of the $300 billion pledge. One reason she said that is that once Trump takes office, the United States will leave the Paris Agreement, greatly reducing the funding contributions of the developed economies. Presidents Joe Biden and Xi Jinping meet for the last time. The two presidents met on the sidelines of the Group of 20 summit in Rio de Janeiro. Biden repeated the usual U.S. reassurances of respect for China's position on Taiwan. Xi seemed to be addressing the incoming Trump administration as much as saying goodbye to Biden. Probably the most important outcome was Xi's statement that under Biden, U.S.-China relations have stabilized. It's an assessment I won't expect to be repeated once Trump takes office. Chinese experts in foreign policy generally expect very difficult trade relations and a confrontational stance by the United States with China. Finally, let me return to new developments in my first story about martial law in South Korea. As it turns out, martial law lasted about 6 hours. When President Yoon saw the huge demonstrations calling for him to resign and the unanimity in the National Assembly that led to a vote to nullify the martial law order, Yoon canceled it. Just like that, the crowds returned home, soldiers left the National Assembly building, and ordinary life resumed. But South Korea's democracy has suffered a major blow since, as I mentioned earlier, this was the first time since the worst days of dictatorship that martial law had been declared. And in conceding defeat, President Yoon did not apologize for his action or withdraw his ridiculous claim that he was forced to act because of threats from pro-North Korean politicians. Now he is isolated and will have great difficulty governing. Just as concerns about North Korea's relations with Russia are at a peak and a new U.S. president is set to take office. The story is thus far from over. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch. She's here with me to share some standout art stories from the paper from around the state. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea. Always enjoy being here.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm excited to dig into what you've brought forth for us today. First up is a jazz story. This one's called Jazz Station. Willamette Jazz Society creates a place to play and connect in Eugene. For folks uninitiated, what is the Jazz Station?
Yeah, the Jazz Station is a place in Eugene. It's run by a nonprofit called the Willamette Jazz Society. It is run mostly by volunteers, 70 volunteers. It just has a few paid staff people. And I love this story because it really talks about the sense of place here. It provides a centralized jazz ecosystem. It's a performing space, but it also has outreach programs for younger people who are getting accustomed to the more advanced jazz playing. I really love the sense of place here, how people who've retired moved to Eugene, they come there and they sort of find their people, they volunteer, it's a real labor of love, I would say. They have a few outreach programs. They have a big band night, and they have something called One Set Wednesday, which gives beginners a chance to lead just one set. Usually pros typically do two sets. So it lets people cut their teeth in leading jazz playing. And so it's those places are designed for the students to come. And then they have something called Jamming with the Pros, where anyone can come and play with professional players. And it's so it's a real intermingling, a real sense of community. I love knowing, too, that you know, it had to shut down during the pandemic, but they took some of the pandemic money that they received. It kept paying the rent, and they were able to renovate it into a new space. And they have a holiday show coming up. They always have a holiday orchestra that puts on a Christmas show every year, which will be December 12th.
It is a cool story. It's cool that the Willamette Jazz Society has a place that's both that's a cafe, a bar, a performing space. It has a listening room, and that it caters to, you know, folks of all ages and experience levels with jazz.
Yeah, I really like that too. I love the very community aspect of it. Mostly, you know, it's a community run place. That is sort of this incubator for new people coming to jazz and for pros to keep playing and bringing people together and jam. I loved it. I love some of the anecdotes in the story too, about how a little 8-year-old girl came to play, handed out charts like a pro to everybody who was there to play with her. It's charming. I love these stories, these cultural hub stories.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that, because this story on the Jazz Station is part of a longer series at Oregon Arts Watch about cultural hubs. What kind of things can you find in these stories from Arts Watch?
Yeah, it's a series that we started a few years ago. It's been hugely popular. We've done 74 stories so far. It prioritizes, for the most part, rural and underserved populations. That's not the only thing it focuses on, but it does prioritize stories. We really try to get around the state, try to feature different areas. And what I love about this series, the way it was sort of conceived, and Esther Barkai, who did the story about the Jazz Station, I think really has a sense of how to do these stories. So the idea is that we really want a sense of place. You know, who are the people behind it who make it go? You know, what is it about this community that makes it unique? How does it serve and reflect that particular community? What drives it? We really want to get to the heart of the place and its people. And we find that these hubs are really important because they build essential connections between people. They really strengthen the social fabric. You know, they are places where we can find our common values. You know, this is what it looks like to be engaged with society. This is how we build trust with each other. And these stories amplify the important good works that people are doing in the community that might not always get recognition that they deserve. So it's the people who make places like this go and are often unsung heroes. So I appreciate that this series gives them a higher profile and tells us what makes these places special.
Over the course of the series, what are some of the types of places that are considered cultural hubs? Can you give some examples?
We have done stories, you know, in the 74 stories that we've written for this series, they've been all over the state. It's about how the Astoria Columbia River Maritime Museum is launching a new expansion. Sometimes it's just about these places that bring people together. There was North Pole Studio, which has a mission to increase opportunities for artists with autism and intellectual or developmental disabilities. So it was a focus on those artists. What else have we done? We've done a movement center in Astoria, trying to get around the state a little bit. The new Performing Arts Center that opened in Corvallis. And we've been around the state. We've been down to Ashland, Lincoln City. Willamina Public Library was a was a very popular story. I like that this series sort of makes us get around the state, and the writers really like writing these stories, and I think they shine. And also, you know, the series actually, it's attracted some bigger writing talent too. So it's been highly successful, I would say. Funders love it. We love it. Readers love it. I love too that it gets a lot of readership both from urban and rural readers. I can tell from the feedback that we receive. So part of the intention of this series is to bridge that urban-rural divide, and I think that it does that.
There's another Arts Watch story that I would love to chat with you about. It's called Breakup Season. Le Grand Film Feature has its Portland premiere. After a successful run on the festival circuit, writer-director H. Nelson Tracy's debut feature screened this Monday, actually, at the Hollywood Theater, and had its Le Grand debut at Eastern Oregon Film Fest. What can you tell me about the film Breakup Season?
I love that this is sort of like a rom-com set up just like a Hallmark movie in a way. I mean, the whole premise of it is that a guy brings his girlfriend back to his Oregon hometown of Le Grand for the holidays to meet his family. But on the first night, she breaks up with him and wants to fly back to Chicago. But a winter storm has come in and made travel impossible. So now she's stuck with the ex-boyfriend and his family for a whole awkward week. And I just... the whole thing makes me laugh. What I loved about this is the writer Mark Mohan traveled to Le Grand to go be there for this screening at the Eastern Oregon Film Festival. He was there last year, so it's kind of nice that he could compare him. Mark does, our regular film critic, always does a really terrific job. This was the 15th year of the festival, and what was nice about this is that it talked about how this film was sort of a pivotal moment for the festival, in that it was an outgrowth of a residency program that was established by the Eastern Oregon Film Festival during the pandemic, and it was a residency program for screenwriters to come there, so they got pandemic money, and they were able to bring a half a dozen screenwriters with the intent that they would be first time feature filmmakers, and then that they would be willing to film in Eastern Oregon. So the festival director Christopher Jennings hatched this idea to do this residency, and he just brought it up in a virtual happy hour in 2020 when everything was shut down and they had to do the festival virtually. And Tracy, the writer and director of this film, loved the idea. So in May of 2021, they were able to bring these screenwriters to Le Grand for a month for a residency. And then this project grew out of that, and it was filmed in Le Grand wasn't just a small budget film either. They had veteran actors and they had a crew that was mostly out of Portland. I liked how Tracy really gave a nod to the Oregon Film Office, which was crucial to getting the film made. There's a lot of infrastructure involved in filming. There's just so many pieces to it, and so he talked about being grateful for the film office here in the state that was able to support the film and get it off the ground. Also, in addition to the screening in Le Grand and in Portland a few days ago, the film will be available on demand via Apple TV starting on Friday, December 6th.
Very cool. I watched the trailer. It looks fun and quite the inversion of a lot of the Christmas movies that we see at this time. And to have the whole thing actually filmed in Le Grand in February of 2023, no less, which is,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. And again, well, two things. This story is kind of similar to the Jazz Station story in that I thought it was cool that they both got pandemic funding, and that these wonderful things grew out of that. You know, that these beneficial things. We often think of the pandemic as just closing things down and everything kind of went into a hole or something. And yet both of these stories talked about how they sort of remade themselves during the pandemic. The Jazz Station completely renovated during the pandemic since it had to shut down. And in this story, a whole sort of residency came out of it, this virtual time. And almost because the festival couldn't be its own, you know, bigger self, they were able to pull off this whole new program that ended up creating this big feature-length film, which has been well-received from all accounts that I've seen.
If our listeners are interested in finding out more about the stories that we've talked about today or any of the other ones from Oregon Arts Watch, what's the best way for them to do that?
They can read all these stories and more at orartswatch.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, just that I hope everybody stays warm and merry during the holidays and gets out and sees some cool shows.
That's a good wish. I wish that for you too, Laura. Thank you so much for coming on KBOO News In Depth.
Thanks for having me, Althea. Really appreciate it.
That was Laura Grimes, Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some recent standout stories from the publication. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
Ready for another year of grassroots community radio? With your support, it's possible. Go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214.